KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Seattle.
We will tear down the apparatus of terror, and we will help you to build a new Iraq that is prosperous and free.
We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney talking about the beginnings of the Iraq War, the date of the Iraq War. 10 years ago today, 3,489 American service members died in combat in that war, according to the latest Department of Defense numbers. More than 35,000 were wounded in combat. Estimates of Iraqi casualties are in the hundreds of thousands, even higher in some estimates, much higher. The aggregate numbers obscure the individual stories, of course, so we'll hear a few of those stories this hour on Weekday as we take a look at the anniversary of the Iraq War. It's Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. Jamie Terabay is contributing editor at the Atlantic Media Company. She's covered the Middle East as a foreign correspondent. From 2005 to 2007, she was Baghdad bureau chief for NPR News. She was part of the team that won the DuPont Columbia Award for their coverage of that war. Jamie Terabay, it's nice to talk to you.
It's so nice to talk to you too, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You know, I wonder, this is mostly about what people recall and remember. So 2005, you get to Iraq. What are some of the first things you remember coming into Baghdad?
Well, I mean, actually, I started working for NPR in 2005. I was there in 2003 in the spring working for the AP. So I really did spend, you know, in the last sort of 10 years of my life looking at what was happening in Iraq from before the invasion and watching it, taking it all in now. And, you know, just looking at all of these images that everyone is bringing out again. Of, you know, the time, you know, that time and how heady things were on the ground in Baghdad and the sort of this idea that it might possibly turn into something more positive than what we had thought. You know, it was so amazing to see, you know, American soldiers in the street parked outside pizza parlors buying pizza for everyone, really, and you know, giving out soda cans. And you know, I was in Humvees in the north that didn't have any windows, let alone doors. And the soldiers that I was with at the time would go into a restaurant without ever worrying that anyone was going to attack them. But, you know, even in the spring of 2003, that there was this real sort of undercurrent of malice. One of the first things that I heard once I landed there was that a soldier had been really shot at point blank range at a university cafeteria where he'd gone to buy some soda. And there was this sense among Iraqis that, okay, you did this, now please leave. And when you watch the apparatus of the American military really began to establish a very solid presence, you knew they weren't going away anytime soon. And all of the headwinds were just rushing towards something that wasn't going to be very, very good for anyone, really.
How did that manifest itself? What do you remember about as that apparatus was put in place? What were some of the things you were seeing?
Oh, there was a lot of disillusionment, and that disillusionment came really quickly. One of the first things that Ambassador Paul Bremer, who replaced Jay Garner at the outset of the occupation, really, one of the first things he did was he dissolved the army. He put 1 million Iraqi soldiers on the street, unemployed, with their guns. And, you know, this was part of the debarification process that they want, that the American administration wanted to do. They wanted to root out anyone who was part of Saddam's Ba'ath Party. But anyone who really wanted a government job needed to join the Ba'ath Party. So these weren't even like mid-level or senior ranking. This was people on the lowest rungs. And that this had just happened right as everyone was talking about winning hearts and minds and all of that stuff. It was more than symbolic. It put people out of work, and it disenfranchised not just the million soldiers, but their families and everyone who relied on them for income. And when everything is sort of swirling around in the aftermath of an invasion and no one really knows what's going to happen next, and you see the people in charge don't know what they're going to do next, to have something so definitive happen in such a negative way was one of the first ways that we began to see the discontentment of the Iraqi people really start to manifest itself.
Jamie Terabay is a reporter. She worked for NPR. She worked for AP. She's now contributing editor at the Atlantic Media Company. She's also author of A Crazy Occupation, Eyewitness to the Intifada. So you were in that changing, swirling situation. Was there any relationship in the way the Iraqis were reacting as that change was happening in their country, as the army was disbanded, as the U.S. started to entrench itself?
Well, it was... one of the biggest misconceptions about the Iraq war was that it was a war, that it was black and white, us versus them, and it was a very clear cut who was fighting with us and who was fighting against us. What it really became was a cluster of small wars. So you saw the Shiite population work very quickly to solidify their power. You saw the Sunnis, who were completely disenfranchised because they had been the ruling sect in Iraq, really sort of start to hit out and see what they could grab. You saw the Kurds in the north really begin to establish their own autonomous area and start reaching out in ways to reconstruct and rebuild and attract investment. And you just really began to see the fragmentation of the country, not geographically, although it became geographic eventually, but really along sectarian lines. And the people who were faced with military presence really began to lash out. You saw in the south, in Basra, they were attacking the British troops. In the Anbar province in the west, they were attacking, the Sunnis were attacking the American troops. And in Baghdad, I say really that everyone was attacking everyone, because that was really where the micro, sort of the cluster of the sort of the ethnicities really intersected.
Say, so Jamie Terabay, did I just either hear a cat, a door, or a child?
Yes. that's my little boy. That's one of the reasons why I don't cover war anymore.
Well, that's what I was wondering. I mean, when you were there, were there any particular moments, or was it one moment where you were looking around and feared for your own safety?
Oh, look, the entire time I was there, it's so interesting, because I'd been in Jerusalem and covering, the Intifada and the West Bank and Gaza. I was very familiar with suicide bombings and the notion of a secondary bomber, which is a lot of what we ended up seeing in Iraq, especially by 2004. I had to really write my will and make my parents like financial power of attorney, because that's when the kidnappings really sort of reached a crescendo. I'm sure you remember the scenes of people in orange jumpsuits and beheadings and these dreadful things. And it just progressively became worse and worse and worse. And you saw a lot of news organizations pull back. You saw a lot of freelancers stop going in there because they couldn't afford. There was no one really there who was willing to cover, their insurance at that basic level. There were several times when you're a war reporter, you are being watched, you're threatened, there's one very clear moment for me in 2007 in Diyala on Nembed, and the Humvee I was in was struck by an IED. And you come away from that and you think that really could have been the end of it for me. So there are lots of moments, and particularly, I lived in Iraq for so long. I lived there for so long, I actually got residency by the Iraqi government. But the people who I worked with, people who went missing, my driver was killed. One of our translators, his father was kidnapped and disappeared. One of my dearest sources inside the Interior Ministry disappeared. And, you just don't even know what happens to any of these people. And our ability to get up and leave and walk away was something that I never forgot, because every time I came back, My staff would say, you came back. But you just know that they cannot leave. And that was really the biggest reason why I felt compelled to keep going there, because if no one was going to tell their stories, then no one would really know.
Well, I appreciated your reporting, and I'm glad you are back with your son, Jamie Terabay. Thank you very much for starting us off.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Jamie Terabay, contributing editor at the Atlantic Media Company, where you can read among her latest works, an article that came out yesterday, Global Opportunity Costs, How the Iraq War Undermined U.S. Influence. The war took its toll in blood and money, but it also damaged American diplomacy, something we'll take up later. This is Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from Edible Seattle Magazine, presenting the 9th Annual Seattle Edible Book Festival at Portage Bay Cafe, Sunday, April 7th. A benefit for Fair Start, which combines literary and culinary arts. Information on participation at edibleseattle.com.
42 degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. Forecast calls for rain this afternoon and a high today of 50. We'll get a more detailed weather forecast for the week ahead and a suggested hike to match the week's forecast in about 40 minutes. It's 9:16.
This is the date that we mark the anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. We're taking a look back and getting some personal stories from some folks who were there, some folks who fought there. Later, some folks who lost family members there. Colonel Darren L. Wright is a U.S. Army officer who served throughout the war in Iraq in combat, leadership, training roles. He served three tours in Iraq, one just after the invasion, one at the start of the insurgency, and one at the very end of the American ground involvement when he took part in the final U.S. patrol, which took him from Baghdad to Kuwait. He's author of Iraq Full Circle, joins us from Joint Base Lewis-McChord. Colonel Wright, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
What's your earliest memory of your combat role in Iraq? What do you remember?
You know, for me, you know, we followed, I was stationed with the 4th ID, so obviously we were supposed to invade from the north out of Turkey. That fell through, so we came up from the south and passed through the lead elements, you know, of the coalition, the Marines and the 3rd ID and some other forces. And what I remember most is, you know, as we entered Baghdad, we'd driven all the way south from Kuwait, but, you know, really as being celebrated, you know, and viewed kind of as liberators. You know, it's like a ticker tape parade minus all the confetti. And then how quickly that changed about 3 months later. And I know the previous guest there talked about it, how people came disenfranchised with us. We had debathification and that sort of thing. But that interesting dynamic where you have so much adrenaline flowing as you're being clapped and cheered and, you know, people yelling USA, and then quickly, you know, that turned.
Why do you think it turned?
Well, I think your first guest had it right by saying that, you know, at the time, and I talk about it in the book, and, you know, the views that I'm expressing are mine and not that of the Army's, but, you know, we didn't have a, you know, sort of phase four plan. In other words, after we destroyed, you know, and dismantled the Iraqi army and they went into hiding, the ones we didn't, you know, kill or capture, and we dismantled the government, took that infrastructure down, we didn't really have that plan, you know, the what now. And so, you know, for the next 7 years, if you will, you know, we kind of figured that out. And then you had the adoption of COIN, a strategy that worked. The surge enabled the COIN to be successful, you know, and then eventually you led to the last patrol. But really, it was absence of a, you know, coherent plan.
Did you feel during that time, was there a moment where you felt that though there wasn't a coherent plan, that your work there was accomplishing something? I mean, was there a moment you really remember, all right, there's a problem here, but this is what we have accomplished?
Yeah, you know, what stands out for me is, number one, we're, you know, we have great soldiers, we have great leaders, you know, the Army itself, the military in general, you know, is a very adaptive and agile organization. And so we were able to adjust on the fly. And so, in other words, through initiative of everybody, you know, and it was going throughout the country. Some did it better than others. But bottom line is, you know, the problem presented itself. You know, here I am an infantry officer. And you turn an infantry unit loose, you know, on a town, it's written in our, you know, kind of core competencies or our medal, our mission essential task, that, you know, you're to close with and destroy the enemy. nowhere in those mission statements, nor had we trained up, you know, to do, you know, to execute the coin fight. In other words, to win the hearts and minds, you know, to serve as de facto mayors, you know, police chiefs, you know, build schools. So we had to, like I said, we were fighting this thing on the fly, and through, you know, initiative, you know, being innovative, you know, we started building, you know, and doing the things that we thought to need to be done, you know. And the one thing that was tough is like, you know, you're kind of a referee in a slugfest as everybody became disenfranchised with the Sunni, Shia, Kurds, or whatever, and, you know, you're trying to, you know, support all sides and try to be neutral. And so that was tough at times.
Colonel Darren L. Wright is a U.S. Army officer, 3 tours in Iraq. He's at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. He's author of Iraq Full Circle. Stay with us, Colonel, here. I want to bring in Command Sergeant Major John W. Troxell. He is at JBLM as well. 5 combat tours, Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, 2 tours Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. Command Sergeant Major John Troxell, thanks for joining us. Oh, let me, there you are. Sergeant Major, thanks for joining us. Not yet? All right. You guys mess with that.
Can you hear me?
Oh, there you go. There you are.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure and honor for me to be here, especially with, you know, such an august audience, including Colonel Darren Wright. So it's truly an honor. I didn't see him in the gym this morning, so he must have been preparing for this interview.
Did you folks know each other in Iraq?
We did not. I first met Colonel Wright a couple years ago when he was commanding the 1st of the 509th Airborne Infantry down in Fort Polk, Louisiana.
So, Sergeant Major Troxell, give me, if you will, compare for me the first time you went to Iraq and then when you went back for Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Yeah, my baptism to combat actually happened in Operation Just Cause in Panama in 1989. I was part of the 82nd Airborne Division we parachuted in. And the hard fighting was over in a few days, but it kind of turned into something similar that we saw in Iraq later on, which was counterinsurgency type operations, because the Panamanian Defense Forces and the Dignity Battalions that supported Manuel Noriega had started clothing themselves in civilian clothes and trying to blend in with the population. And having spent 12 years in the 82nd Airborne Division and being part of a rapid deployable force kind of prepared me for combat. So, you know, it was just kind of bred in me that everything I did as a soldier and as a leader was to prepare for combat. So initially when the war kicked off after 9/11, you know, I knew that sooner or later I was going to have to go fight. So I ended up taking my Air Cavalry Squadron out of the 10th Mountain Division, and I was attached to the 3rd Striker Brigade here, the 1st Striker Brigade to be employed in combat in Iraq. And I arrived in November of 2003. Pretty much the 4th Infantry Division, along with the 3rd Infantry Division and the Marines, had already defeated the Iraqi forces. And as Colonel Wright alluded to, we were basically in Phase 4 now, trying to stabilize and working towards Phase 5, enabling the new Iraqi forces. So already the insurgency had started. So I understood at the time that we were going to be fighting an enemy that was blending in with the population, that was going to conduct terrorist type attacks and was not going to fight us head on. So I had to shape my organization, and especially the mindset of my organization, that the enemy doesn't play by the rules. Okay, so get over it, all right, and figure out how we're going to get after the enemy. And the way we did that was through working with the center of gravity, which was the population, and making sure that they had basic services and everything, all the while beginning a deliberate targeting process to get after enemy leaders.
Did that make them mad, the population?
Well, initially, you know, as Colonel Wright said, you know, they looked at U.S. forces as liberators, but because of the situation we were in at the time, and it was tough for us to get the government and the basic services up and moving, and also starting to develop a military and a police, I think they became disenfranchised because they weren't seeing results in what they thought was a timely manner. You know, if you think Saddam Hussein ruthlessly ruled for over 30 years, and in order to change how that country was going to do business, it wasn't going to take 1 or 2 years. And as we all know, it took us 10 years before the conditions were right on the ground that we withdrew. So, yes, they were there were some disenfranchised and disgruntled civilians, but again, you know, our job was to continue to engage with them and let them know things were going to get better and that we were working to make things better and that we were working to take the bad people off the battlefield so that it would be easier for things to get better.
Let me bring in one more guest here, and then I want to ask you about lessons learned from all three of you. That was Command Sergeant Major John W. Troxell. Ed Hrivnak is a professional firefighter, a retired flight nurse from Air Force Reserve. He's written Wounded, A Legacy of Operation Iraqi Freedom. It's about the sacrifices the wounded made and the strain of caring for them. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me back on the show, Steve.
What's your earliest memory of Iraq?
My earliest memory would be the first combat mission where we went to fly in wounded. And at that time, I had already had 17 years in the active duty and reserve and was a veteran of Desert Shield and Desert Storm. And I thought I was a prepared, trained flight nurse and was ready for it. But the wave of casualties that came in was far different from Desert Storm. And I just remember being completely overwhelmed when the first load of Humvees and ambuses came. The training I had and even my civilian experience as a trauma nurse and as a firefighter didn't prepare me for the arms and legs and the combat trauma that we experienced.
You know, so we learned that was in part because the IEDs were much more powerful than what was being deployed and that it took time to change those machineries. What was the reaction from those people who were maybe not as wounded, so people you could talk to, about the equipment that was being used and deployed? And what was your own thinking about that?
There was kind of a universal understanding that we had enough supplies for 6 weeks. They did not plan on a very long war. And I remember the frustration of the ambulatory casualties that they didn't have armored-up vehicles. They didn't have enough water. That was a big issue. But more importantly, what I was really surprised by the wounded who could verbalize to me is they didn't care about their wounds. They were more concerned about the guy laying next to them. And they always said, hey, take care of that guy next to me first. Give him the morphine first. The amount of compassion I saw between our soldiers and our airmen for each other, I'd never experienced anything like that before.
Training? Is that training? Is that camaraderie? What's happening there, do you think?
I think it goes past training. I think the reality hit that we realized that we were in that battle for each other and that we only had each other. And you very much became to rely on complete strangers who were actually brothers because they were wearing the same uniform, had the same haircut, we were speaking the same lingo, and we were all tied together by our military heritage.
So I'd like to ask all three of you a question about two questions, one about chaos and then about lessons learned. So Ed Hrivnak, I mean, receiving the information, it seemed like there was order, as we heard, order and then chaos and then a restoration of some order with real costs. Do you remember that moment? Did it seem that way to you?
Absolutely. We saw the same effect on the medevac side. After the initial ground invasion was over, there was a period of calm. And we actually sent half of our medevac crews home because we thought the war was over. And then the chaos started. And it was very clear that a guerrilla war had started, and we were overwhelmed with casualties. We were not prepared for it. And then the IEDs, something that we really didn't see in the initial invasion, these roadside bombs, the horrific injuries that occurred from this, we did not see in the first 2-3 weeks of the war. And we were literally overwhelmed by it.
You know, Command Sergeant Major John Troxell, you talked about having to acknowledge that you had a different kind of person you were fighting. But It's difficult, isn't it, to both intellectually know that and then to be out every day trying to figure out which woman, child, man might be your enemy. I mean, we always hear during that time of chaos that it got hard, it got chaotic for the soldiers. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I will tell you, I have to agree, it was chaotic, but I will tell you, leaders at all level in the Army and the military are bred and born through training and education to bring sanity to chaos. And I'll give you an example. I was the 4th Striker Brigade Command Sergeant Major, and I was Surge Brigade number 4 going into Iraq in 2007. We had went to the northern Baghdad Belt, an area that had not had a lot of U.S. forces operating extensively in there. And within the first 8 days of taking over that battle space, or excuse me, the first 7 days, my commander and I made 8 trips to the morgue. And we had well over 200 wounded in the first week we were there. And, you know, it's kind of like you're in a boxing ring and you've been hit pretty good and you're up against the ropes and your nose is bleeding. And you've got one of two things to do at that point in time. You either concede and cover up and wait for the referee to pull you out, or you figure out how you're going to get back on the offensive. So my commander came to me and said, hey, what are we going to do? These roadside bombs, you know, they keep blowing our strikers up. And I said, I'll tell you what we're going to do, sir. We're going to get out of these strikers, and we're going to get into the enemy's support and security zones, and we're going to disrupt what they're doing. We're going to deliberately target them, and we're going to get after them. And we are going to gain the initiative and keep it, and we're going to eliminate the threats out here.
Did you take more casualties by doing that?
No, we did not. Our casualties went down because of the offensive we went on. When you get into the enemy's decision cycle and into his support and security zone, now he has to figure out how to defend himself. Now, they do that through a deliberate use of IEDs, but we understood that. So we had to get better at detecting and identifying IEDs and using the equipment that we were issued to try and dismantle the IEDs. And in some cases, it was simply bypass the enemy support zone, hit them from a vulnerable spot. But because we did that, in the space of 15 months, we went from about 200 attacks a week in our battle space down to almost 2 or 3 by the time we left. And a lot of that was not only deliberately targeting the enemy, but it was continuing to build the Afghan security forces. And you've heard of a term called Sons of Iraq, where the citizens themselves were pulling security in the local neighborhoods to make sure that the insurgents weren't coming in and planting roadside bombs. Over.
Yeah. All right. So, Colonel Wright, let me end with you on this question of lessons learned here. You wrote Iraq Full Circle. You were trying to figure out some of the lessons learned. We're not at the end of war in our culture, so we're still in a war. Overall, what's the takeaway from, I know it's a very broad question, but for you, a couple of takeaways from this Iraq war? Oh, did I lose Colonel Wright? Oh, that's why it was ringing. All right. I'll ask you that, Ed Hrivnak. What's your takeaway from it? I mean, you're in the reserve now. You're not active duty.
Well, I actually retired in 2007.
So you can step even further away. What's your takeaway?
You know, I don't.
I guess it's more personal than I was asking policy. For you, it's a little more personal.
It is a little more personal, because I don't know if I can. I have a global takeaway, a strategic takeaway, because I don't think the history's been written on Iraq yet. It's still yet to be seen what's going to happen with that country. From a personal note, I think that for any soldier or airman that comes home from war, there's adjustment, whether you're wounded or not. I think all of us deal with a certain amount of what's referred to as a moral injury. We reflect back on what we did in the war zone, and all of us had to make difficult decisions. Some of us carry guilt from some of those decisions. And I think the takeaway is that when you come home, you have to take the time and learn how to live with those decisions and move forward. And
yeah.
I think a lot of our soldiers still struggle with that.
Yeah. I mean, the war started 10 years ago. It's not over yet.
Right.
All right. We'll leave it with that with our guests. I guess we lost Colonel Wright. We'll have to get him back another time. We were talking with Colonel Darren L. Wright, Command Sergeant Major John W. Troxell, and Ed Hrivnak, professional firefighter and retired flight nurse. I Appreciate all you guys talking with us. Thank you. Let me turn to Dustin Langan. Dustin Langan worked as a translator and interpreter for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad from 2003 to 2004. And during that time, he was involved in mass grave excavations, landmine removal, debathification interviews, a lot more. He's also author of Freedomization, a satirical novel about the Iraq War. He joins us from Barcelona. Dustin Langan, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
So 10 years on, I guess my first question for you is, what's your first memory of Baghdad and the Iraq War, as you recall it?
Yeah, it was late April, and we just drove through on a convoy of SUVs, brand new SUVs purchased in Kuwait, very conspicuous. Yeah. And we drove in a long convoy up to the Republican Palace, which had been bombed and was Saddam's old palace, to where we started setting up shop. No electricity, broken glass on the floor, eating MREs. And we set up the ministries in different rooms of the building. At first, with just collapsible chairs and desks. It was very, very, very basic.
You know, we talked to a couple of men, three men who were fighting. What was your work? What were you doing in April 2003 to 2004 on a regular basis?
I was a contract linguist. I spoke Arabic. I speak Arabic. And so I was quite in demand in the beginning. I was necessary. Someone like me was necessary to speak with a lot of the Iraqis just to figure out what to do and how to move. And for just about any time anybody from the coalition government left to go out into the world to talk to anybody, they needed an interpreter to go with them. So in the beginning, I had many, many different jobs. But around the third month or so, I started working on civil society, working with Iraqi NGOs.
When you did that, then you would see the shift that means, I guess, the beginning of the shifts, as we heard earlier, people feeling a little more resentful to the Americans for coming, making the change, and maybe not having that step four or maybe not leaving. What kind of reactions were you getting if you did see that shift in attitude?
Oh, sure. I mean, in the beginning, quite a few people, especially those who were working close to us for a combination of reasons, were exuberant. Many Iraqis were quite exuberant, and they had outlandish expectations of what was to come. But unfortunately, we couldn't even provide the most basic things. And the lack of public utilities, particularly electricity, which was also required to keep the sewage pumps going, these types of things just undermined faith quite quickly, especially as the heat climbed. Without electricity, very few things were possible, and it became impossible to live. So the resentment grew quite quickly.
When did you leave?
I left in February 2004.
And why did you leave?
Because I was working with Iraqi NGOs, and it was very hard but very interesting work. And yet I felt that I had given quite a lot, and that after a year, I was drinking a lot. I was working 15, 16 hours a day, and I would have continued to do that in that environment, in that situation. So I just removed myself after a lot of struggle about it, because the Iraqis obviously could not leave. I decided that I had to leave for myself.
That was the pressure of the war, the pressure of the job.
Yeah.
When you wrote Freedomization, which is a satirical novel, what were you trying to, purge, maybe is a way to put it?
Yeah, I was trying to settle my thoughts, I think. I was trying to approach what had happened there from different points of view. There's a strong Iraqi component in the book, as well as an American component. And I wanted to try to make sense of what had happened there, and why America went to war, what type of trying to create the world in our own image, and our proud defense of our values and our desire to spread those values around the world, and what happens when those lofty ideals come into contact with some real tough reality.
Did you make any Iraqi friends over there that you are still in contact with?
Yes. A lot of our staff members and other translators and interpreters. Absolutely.
How?
And some other people who were not working with us at all, but were people with whom I worked, Iraqi civilians. But in the blur of things, I've lost contact with those people. Yeah.
So these are friends. These are people that work closely. These are people that had a stake in what was happening. Do you recall how their – I know this is in early on and much happened after 2004. But do you recall how they first received your arrival?
Quite a few of them were very hopeful. A lot of their only experience with foreigners was through movies. And in the movies, the Americans are, you know, they destroy alien beings. They're super powerful. They can do all kinds of things. So the expectations were quite high. But then, of course, they're also Iraqis, and many of them have lived trying lives, and so the cynicism crept in quite quickly as well. It was a very fragile, precious time there in the spring of 2003.
Yeah.
And it slipped away pretty quick.
All right, Dustin Langan, I appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Take care. Dustin Langan worked as a translator and interpreter for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad from April 2003 to February 2004. He's also written a novel about his time there, Freedomization. Now let me turn to Andrew Bacevich. He's a professor of international relations at Boston University, also a retired Army colonel, veteran of the Vietnam War. His son, Army First Lieutenant Andrew Bacevich Jr., was killed in Iraq in 2007. He's been a critic of the war since it started, and an updated edition of his book has just come out, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. It's being published this month, actually. Andrew Bacevich, good to talk to you again.
Well, thanks for having me on the program.
I want to start with the painful part, because I want to talk to you about some of the things you've written, but of all the people we've talked to today so far, you are the person who lost a family member, who lost a son in that war. And I just am curious if you would share with us, how'd you get notified?
Oh, you know, it's been a longstanding rule of mine that I like to keep these things private. And,
all right, that's fair enough. I remember that from you in the past, saying that. That was something that you kept private. I'm sorry I forgot. You know, when we talked to the Air Force Reserve and professional firefighter, he talked about that the legacy of the wounded keep going on and the legacy of the war keeps going on. You wrote an article to Paul Wolfowitz in Harper's asking him how he was seeing the legacy of that war. Maybe how he was thinking about it. What was the gist of that article?
Well, I Dr. Wolfowitz, of course, was a major figure in the planning within the Bush administration that led to creating the logic for the invasion of Iraq. I know him a little bit back when he was the dean of a school in Washington, where I was briefly employed. And he struck me then as a very imaginative and very smart guy. And the gist of the letter is to say, we need a smart guy like you to help us to understand this catastrophic event. We should not forget the Iraq War. We should instead study it, probe it, learn from it, make sure we don't repeat these mistakes. And to my mind, he's the kind of person who... if he summoned up the courage and the honesty, could actually help us understand why this horrific event occurred and why it turned out as badly as it did. And the basic letter says is, why don't you think about this and give it your best shot.
Have you ever heard, have you heard back?
No. I honestly didn't expect to. I mean, the real point was not to my expectation was not that he would respond. My real point was, in a sense, to remind readers that we have been too hasty, I think, as a people in forgetting this war, and we have not insisted that our political leaders explain candidly what they thought they were doing and why it turned out so wrong. And I regret that absence of accountability deeply.
Of course, the soldiers haven't forgotten it, not the ones that we've talked to today that thought it was a good or a bad idea, and not the people that have worked there. Do you think that the leaders, I've listened to them, I'm sure you listened to them the past few days, justifying the war, arguing for their decisions? I heard Stephen Hadley talk about why they did what they did and why it was a good idea. Do you think they have moved away from it, intellectualized it?
Yeah, I think I read some of the stuff that Hadley's been saying, and it's dishonest. He's kidding himself if he thinks that invading Iraq was a good idea because that would give us a chance to fight al-Qaeda. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq until we invaded the country. There's still al-Qaeda there today, blowing up bombs in downtown Baghdad because of our invasion of Iraq. So Hadley is, I think, a good example of somebody who is either very stupid or utterly dishonest in his unwillingness to face up to the actual consequences of U.S. policy there.
So one of the questions you asked in that article, one of the questions you've talked about in your book, why did liberation at gunpoint yield results that differed so radically from what the war's advocates had expected? Why? Why did it?
I think one answer is a fundamental misunderstanding of war. It may be a little bit hard for people to remember here in 2013, but back in the wake of 9/11, in many respects, back in the wake of Operation Desert Storm, back in 1991, many people in Washington, and more generally, I think, people around the country, had reached the conclusion that we had war figured out, that the U.S. military was unbeatable, that when we sent U.S. forces into battle, they were going to win quickly, decisively, economically. Those expectations, I think, helped to fuel the war fever in 2002 and into 2003. What we have learned since, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, is despite the fact that we have a wonderful military and many wonderful soldiers, we don't know how to win wars. And in fact, the wars that we have been undertaking over the past decade have turned out to be anything but decisive. They've turned out to be anything but brief. And they have certainly turned out to be exceedingly costly. I mean, there are new estimates that on Iraq alone, the cost of the war is up till now is $2.2 trillion, with, you know, bills to be paid probably for the next 30 or 40 years. That's a catastrophe. We don't have that kind of money to waste.
Well, of course, the bills being paid for the wounded across America and across Iraq and the rest of the world are bills that will be paying and also debating in Congress how to pay for decades to come.
And what makes it, of course, sadder still, that we don't even do a good job of meeting our obligation to our veterans. There's any amount of information you want that suggests that the Department of Veterans Affairs is one of the most inefficient bureaucracies in Washington, D.C. That, too, I think, is deeply regrettable.
You know, I was reading some of the afterword you wrote for your book, New American Militarism: How Americans Are Seduced by War, and I wonder about two things I want to ask you. One was about Robert Gates and whether Gates was an antidote to the Secretaries of Defense we had, and whether he helped right the ship in some way or not. What do you think?
A little bit. I mean, I think, anybody would have been an improvement over Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense. I think Gates, on balance, did a good job. And I think what we might call the Gates Doctrine, remember he gave that speech at West Point shortly before he left office, where he said that any future Secretary of Defense recommending that we send a large land army to the Middle East or East Asia ought to have his head examined. When he was saying that, I think most Americans had already reached that conclusion, but it was useful, I think, for a respected public figure like Gates to lay down that marker. We are not going to be invading countries in the Islamic world anytime soon, and I'm grateful for that. However, that said, Gates, President Obama, by no means have given up the notion that we should be employing hard power far and wide in pursuit of our objectives. What we have under the current president is simply a change in methods. Rather than invading and occupying countries, he's shown a willingness to use drones and special operations forces wherever he finds it necessary to go kill somebody. And there are times when we need to kill people, but I would sort of want to make the point that simply killing bad guys does not constitute a strategy. It does not constitute a policy. If indeed there is animus in the Islamic world toward the United States, perhaps it would be useful in between killing people that we ask ourselves how we came to have this poisoned relationship and whether or not there can be actions taken on our part that can, in some respect, at least over time, to alleviate that poisoned relationship.
Is there a direct line from George Bush's doctrine of preventative war to what President Obama is undertaking today?
I think so. I mean, I think that the Obama doctrine, this use of drones, is in a sense a refinement of or a second generation version of President Bush's doctrine of preventive war.
When you look back on this war, and you look back on it as an analyst, how does it hit you emotionally? How does it hit you in the gut?
Well, again, that kind of gets into personal matters. But, I mean, I would say as a historian, one of the things that strikes me is how quick we are to forget things that are unpleasant. I don't mean we, you, and me, but I mean as a people. In class this morning, I asked my students if they were aware of the fact that we're now at the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War, and they were not aware of it. And they're wonderful kids. They got a lot going on in their lives. They work hard. But as far as they're concerned, the Iraq War is over, and now that it's over, it's not something that they think about. And I think that their attitude in many respects is consistent with the attitude of most of the American people, and I think that's unfortunate.
All right, sir. I appreciate you taking the time this morning to talk to us a little bit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Andrew Bacevich is professor of international relations, Boston University, served in the military, graduate of West Point. Is The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War and the Limits of Power are out. This is Weekday.
-43 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For more than three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
President Obama will soon visit Israel and the occupied West Bank. That's where an Israeli project would expand settlements and could undermine peace efforts.
We have a lot of children who were raised here, were educated here. Now they want to live in the place they have been born.
Israel's so-called E1 project, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the City of Seattle, helping to reduce pollution in the Lower Duwamish Waterway by searching out and controlling sources and working with businesses to keep pollutants out of stormwater. More information online at seattle.gov by searching Protect Duwamish.
9:53. If the Defense of Marriage Act is overturned, the tax status of thousands of married same-sex couples will change. Find out what you need to know about same-sex marriage and taxes in about 15 minutes.
Every Tuesday on Weekday, Michael Fagan matches a hike to the week's weather. We'll shift gears from thinking about the war, but not forgetting it, talking about the weather and the hike. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, is it going to snow?
Well, spring starts tomorrow at 4 a.m.
That's what they tell me.
And and going with that theme, we are looking at a strong storm moving through the area. For one thing, we're looking at a 1 to 2 feet of new snow at Stevens Pass and Paradise at Mount Rainier. Also looking at some windy conditions in the city, winds 30, 40 miles per hour, perhaps some stronger gusts, perhaps an inch of rain in some locations. And for Wednesday afternoon and evening, the Puget Sound Convergence Zone forms, and we might see some snow or hail at 500 feet and above. So a little bit of everything. So for Wednesday, a good thing to do would be to work and get your taxes done. How's that?
That's good. That'll be the hike we take for Wednesday, huh?
That's right. And, you know, today we have two hikes. Westburg Trail, folks were asking for a trail that they can get into the sun. And this one's near Ellensburg. In fact, if you head out today, like right after my segment is done. It's about an hour and a half drive from Bellevue to get to the trailhead. And this is mostly snow-free. We were out there 2 weeks ago. There was some snow. It's probably all gone by now. One thing I really like about this hike, it has some of the best views of Mount Stewart. You can almost reach out and touch it. It's so close. And the hike is reasonable mileage. It's 5 miles round trip, 1,700-foot gain. And one thing, again, for views, if you head out today, it will be good, or Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. On your way down from the trip, you want to put some traction devices on those yak tracks or micro spikes. It's very muddy this time of the year. That's the downside of this hike. The flowers aren't quite out yet. That's more for mid or later in April. And if you're looking for a quick hike closer to the area, Rattlesnake Mountain is always a good one, and or Rattlesnake Ledge. But do that today and not tomorrow, because tomorrow's going to be very windy and blustery. And for the Rattlesnake Mountain, if you do that, you need a Discover Passes Screen Trails Map 205S. And for the Westberg hike, you don't even need a permit, which is good. It's on Kittitas Reclamation District land. So there you have it.
You know, this is, you're taking people out to some of my favorite places. I love going out to that South Thorpe Highway and Menashtash Road. Those are real interesting parts of the state. And have you, do you hike extensively out there this time of year?
I start to. I haven't done it that much in the past, but I'm going to, the way things are going with the weather, I'll be going out there more often. So this is the first time I've done this hike. So I'll be going out with Karen Seitz, I call her the flower child. She knows all the flowers, and she tries to educate me on them. I also go out with Alan Bauer. So they do a lot of hikes in that area, so they'll be dragging me along. And, yeah, we'll be posting quite a few of those hikes as time goes on during the spring.
Well, I noticed that you have the picture up, and from the summit of this place where there's frisbees and a post, you overlook the valley, the Kittitas Valley, and a whole bunch of windmills, wind turbines in the distance as you get closer to Mount Stewart.
Yeah, that's right. There's a big wind farm from Puget Sound Energy, and it's sort of neat seeing that at a distance. And we did do one of those hikes right by the wind farm several weeks ago. So, yeah, we'll be doing a lot of hikes in that area, because I know a lot of folks are asking for snow-free hikes and flower hikes, and that's where you go in the east part of the Cascade. So we'll be off and running there quite a bit.
Westberg Trail, or closer in, Rattlesnake Mountain. Michael Fagan's weather and hike blog is hikewashington.net. Hike Washington's one word. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather, LLC. Michael, good talking to you again.
Same here. Talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of a 19 and under rugby game being played at Magnuson Park, the Seattle Vikings versus the Liberty Rugby Club, with a chorus of frogs in the background.
Those frogs are going down.
they don't have the power of the rugby player. The listener Tim says the frogs live nearby in their own wetland nature preserve. And as are they cheering or booing, Bernard, those frogs?
It's hard to tell. I don't know this dialect.
What sounds are you hearing? Record 30 seconds of some interesting sound. That's a nice juxtaposition right there, frogs and rugby. Send it to us, along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. We'll talk more. We'll do some more weekday just ahead.
-44 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Looks like rain this afternoon and a high of 50. Tonight, breezy, rainy, a low of 45. And tomorrow, Wednesday, windy with showers and a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. And again, a high of 50.
Support for KUOW comes from Bainbridge Graduate Institute, with master's programs committed to developing leaders of change. Open house March 20th at their new location in Pioneer Square. RSVP and more information at bgi.edu.
How do you feel about being watched by surveillance cameras in public places? Is it an intrusion of your privacy, or does it make you feel safer? Let us know what you think right now by calling 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. We're sharing your thoughts on camera surveillance of public places today during the noon hour. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, collecting contributions for 10 local food banks during a spring food drive in March. Donations will be...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.